This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up, tax cuts will be on state lawmakers' minds as they return to their home districts. Minnesota-based United Healthcare makes a big purchase, and the search continues for a missing U of M student. It's Monday, March 30th. I'm John Wanamaker. Minnesota lawmakers will be thinking about taxes when they return to the Capitol next week, not the looming April 15th filing deadline, but rather how much they should cut taxes with the nearly $1.9 billion budget surplus. And it won't be easy. House Republicans want $2 billion in tax cuts. DFL Governor Mark Dayton and Senate Democrats want far less. And they're warning that a too hefty giveback would set the stage for future deficits. Tim Pugmire has more.
With 10 days off, legislators are back home in their districts for some time to reconnect and recharge. House Tax Committee Chair Greg Davids, a Republican from Preston, said he has other plans.
I'm taking the spreadsheets with me over Easter break, and I'll be spending a lot of time on this Easter vacation, not being on vacation.
Davids is trying to piece together a tax bill that meets the House Republican goal of $2 billion in cuts. He said he's paring down a stack of proposals that already tops $9 billion. House Republicans haven't specified which taxes they plan to cut, but a big share of their proposals, including the session's first bill introduction, are aimed at helping businesses. David said his strategy is to touch as many taxes as possible.
I don't have it drafted up yet, but I can see starting to phase certain things out so you can do more things. Rather than just one or two big things, whether it be the estate tax, whether it be not tax Social Security, whether it be veterans benefits, the child care tax credit that the governor is supporting.
David said his goal is to pass a tax bill that Governor Dayton will sign. That's why he's not trying to repeal the income tax increase on top earners that Dayton signed into law in 2013.
Why would you go after the governor's premier legislation when you want a bill signed? That makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I like to skip the political part of things and get right to the policy.
But $2 billion in other cuts would send back roughly the same amount of money that Dayton's income tax increase brought in. Dayton said last week that taking away that much tax revenue would come back to haunt lawmakers.
Saying goes, you know, if those who don't learn the lesson of history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. I mean, it's just setting us up for another fiscal collapse and borrowing from the schools and all the things that we spent the last 4 years digging Minnesota out of, and the growing Minnesota economy has spent getting us out of. And now people who just evidently don't remember or don't care about what happened back then seem to be prepared to do it again.
The tax relief in Dayton's revised budget plan totals $197 million, most of it for an expansion of child care tax credits. Senate Democrats announced last week that they're proposing a similar number, about $225 million. They've said property tax relief and aid to local governments will be part of their tax plan. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach also cautioned against repeating past mistakes. Bach said there won't be a replay of the 1999 tax rebate checks that were a signature issue of another governor, Jesse Ventura.
I got an email last night from a guy that said, I'm a Republican. He said, but don't send me $350. I think most Minnesotans understand that it's better to invest that money in our public infrastructure or in our educational systems when we have some resources, or in our budget reserve when we have some resources around.
Bach said restraint is needed from all sides in the end-of-session negotiations to ensure a sound structural budget for the next legislature. Lawmakers have until May 18th to finish their work. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
The extensive renovation of the Minnesota Capitol building is $30 million over budget, state officials revealed last week. That number surprised members of the Capitol Preservation Board, but they heard an even more surprising number. Just 17 pieces of art in the building have an estimated value of nearly $1 billion. Tom Scheck reports.
The architect in charge of the Capitol reconstruction says most of the $30 million overrun is due to water damage around the foundation of the Capitol. David Hart said crews need to reconstruct two of the stairways leading into the Capitol and further waterproof the building.
As we began the demolition in the basement and as we started to reveal certain areas of the exterior, we started to identify the exterior wall on the interior of the building. we started to recognize the degree to which water was coming into the building.
Hart said the recommendation also includes $6 million for security, landscaping, and other repairs. The Capital Preservation Commission agreed to recommend that the legislature spend $20 million to make the repairs and waterproof the building. The commission delayed action on many of the other requests until it gets more information. Many members of the commission, including Republican Senator Dave Senjum, said they need to spend the money to protect the Capitol.
Water is the enemy of any building, and it just seems to me instinctively we're into this thing for a lot of money already that we shouldn't cease to fix it up properly and intact and bring this thing back to a condition that can go for another 100 years.
If all of the requests are funded, the total cost of the Capitol renovation will top $300 million. The job is scheduled to run through 2017. The Capitol Preservation Commission also recommended the legislature spend $3.25 million to conserve and restore 17 pieces of art in the Capitol. Many of the paintings and murals, including work by John LaFarge, Edward Simmons, and Howard Pyle, are priceless. But Ted Lentz, with the Cass Gilbert Society, tried to put a value on the artwork. He said he believes the 17 pieces are worth $987 million. He said the painted murals in the Rotunda, the Supreme Court, and the Senate Chamber are a piece of Minnesota's history.
It tells a great story. It tells this incredible story of the vision of the legislators and the architect and the commission at the time, how to tell the story of Minnesota.
But several members of the commission say they want some new artwork in the Capitol. They want to include art that reflects Minnesota's history since the Capitol was built in 1905. A commission subcommittee will consider adding art that reflects the state's cultural changes. Governor Mark Dayton said he'd like to see many of the governor's portraits around the Capitol replaced with other artwork. He also said he'd like to see changes in some of the art in the governor's reception room that focuses on Minnesota's involvement in the Civil War and images featuring Native Americans. Dayton said he worries some of the pieces are factually inaccurate and about the overall message.
Each one is significant in its own right, but as the only seven that are, you know, in that office, and given that it is the office of the governor of Minnesota, is that, you know, somebody comes in and says that's what, you know, that's the only thing that matters in terms of your history and representation.
But Ted Lentz with the Cass Gilbert Society says he doesn't think the reception room should be changed.
The various questions, well, should we replace the art in that, would be a little bit like suggesting painting out sections of the Sistine Chapel because it no longer is theologically correct. Well, that's, no pope is going to change that. And I believe that building, that room itself, is a work of art.
The renovation will soon relocate the legislature. The Senate has to move out in June. They'll hold floor sessions next year in the new Senate office building that's scheduled to open. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach renewed his call for the House to find a different place to meet outside the Capitol in 2016. He said it will save money if crews can continue working uninterrupted next year. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota-based United Health will purchase the pharmacy benefits manager Catamaran for about $12 billion. United Health reports that it will pay $61.50 per share to combine its Optum Rx pharmacy business with Catamaran. Pharmacy benefits managers negotiate prices for new and specialty drugs. They also process claims and administer prescription plans for insurers and employers. Together, the new combined company is projected to fill about 1 billion prescriptions annually. United Health estimates that the market for the specialty pharmacy services provided by the company will grow from $100 billion last year to $400 billion in 2020. Regulators still need to sign off on the purchase. Students at the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus say they're taking more precautions after a student went missing early Friday. 22-year-old Jennifer Houle was last seen at the Blarney Pub and Grill in Dinkytown at about 1 o'clock Friday morning. Her purse was found a few hours later, about four blocks away. Christine Noldy, a senior at the U, graduated from Stillwater Area High School in 2011 with Houle. She says a reported sexual assault near campus last Monday and her friend's disappearance have made many students feel uneasy.
It's not safe, and even my parents called me and wanted to just move me home for the rest of the year because I'm a senior, and they feel very, very worried about all of us girls on campus. And I feel like we have a false sense of security since it's Stinky Town and a college campus, but we're also, you know, in the middle of Minneapolis, and for me, it's made me realize that a little bit more.
Minneapolis police have added investigators to aid in the search for Houle. Police are asking the public to come forward with any information. Authorities have released the names of two Pine River residents killed in a small plane crash in central Minnesota. The Cass County Sheriff's Department says 43-year-old John Witt and his passenger, 32-year-old Stacy Sundquist, were killed when the plane went down Friday evening near the Pine River Airport. Witnesses reported the plane was flying, quote, low and slow before it crashed. The Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board are investigating the incident. Members of the Twin Cities Liberian community are pleading for the safe return of a missing 10-year-old boy. There was a prayer service over the weekend for Barway Collins of Crystal. The boy disappeared shortly after school on March 18th. Searchers have recovered the body of a missing 77-year-old fisherman from a lake in northern Wisconsin. Bayfield County authorities say Lewis Bickle of Mason had gone ice fishing on Perch Lake in the town of Drummond on Saturday. His wife reported him missing that night. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Commuters traveling west into downtown Minneapolis today are seeing some changes. As the Viking Stadium construction ramps up, 5th Street between 11th Avenue and Park Avenue is closing to westbound traffic on the south side of the stadium. This particularly affects people who use 5th Street to exit off of I-94. Michelle Kelm-Helgen is chair of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority. She says the size of the stadium required the permanent closure.
5th Street will just be closed because we need additional room for the stadium, which is obviously much larger than the old Metrodome.
Kelm-Helgen says by the end of summer, the city of Minneapolis will reverse one lane of eastbound 6th Street to help traffic flow from the interstate. Authorities say scaffolding at the Viking Stadium construction site collapsed onto a downtown street over the weekend because of the high winds. The Minneapolis Police Department says the incident happened late yesterday afternoon. The department says there wasn't any traffic in the area at the time. Minneapolis Police Spokesman John Elder says the roof of a trailer was damaged, but that no injuries were reported. A new rule designed to make North Dakota crude oil safer to transport takes effect this week. North Dakota regulators say the changes will make oil transported from the Bakken oil fields less volatile. Critics say the rule will not make oil trains any safer. Dan Gunderson reports.
In the past 2 years, several trains carrying North Dakota crude oil have exploded and burned. The Federal Department of Transportation says that's because North Dakota Bakken crude is more volatile than other crude oil. The oil contains gases that increase the risk of explosion. The oil industry disputes the government report, arguing Bakken crude is no different than other light crude oil and that most North Dakota crude already meets the new standard. The new North Dakota regulation sets a standard for vapor pressure. That's a measure of volatile gases in the oil. Oil that doesn't meet the standard requires a process called conditioning, heating the oil to release some of those volatile gases.
I think a lot of people have wondered, well, you know, is this going to cure the problem? And our answer is that by itself, it is not the cure.
Lynn Helms is the state's top oil regulator. He says the new oil conditioning rule is a step in the right direction, but he adds that safer rail cars are also a critical part of the solution. The federal government is considering new rules for safer tank cars that might include thicker steel shells and larger pressure relief valves.
If you combine our lower vapor pressure standard with these high-capacity relief valves, we should be able to get away from these boiling liquid explosive vapor incidents, which create the large explosions if and when we have a derailment.
Larger relief valves could allow rapidly expanding gases to escape, preventing the rail tank cars from exploding. But critics point out those volatile gases could still catch fire, and they argue North Dakota could make the oil much safer. Don Morrison with the Dakota Resource Council, a North Dakota environmental group, urged the state to require stabilization of oil. That process uses heat to remove even more of the volatile gases. But North Dakota officials say the more stringent requirement would cost oil companies as much as $2 per barrel. The option chosen by the state will cost an estimated 10 cents a barrel.
Here's what's happening. The bottom line profitability of the oil industry is trumping our safety.
Don Morrison says much of the light crude oil in Texas is stabilized before it's shipped. That takes the process of conditioning crude oil one step further to remove more of the gases. Stabilization standards are typically set by the companies that buy the oil.
To stabilize the oil so it is safer, like they do in Texas, oil companies are going to have to spend some money. This is true. But isn't that a cost of doing business?
The North Dakota Petroleum Council, which represents the oil industry, did not respond to an interview request. Fred Millar is a Washington-based lobbyist and consultant on hazardous materials transportation. He contends the new North Dakota standards would not have changed the outcome of a deadly oil train explosion in Canada.
The standards imposed in North Dakota are so weak that the train at Lac Mégantic that killed 47 people would not have had its volatility reduced.
Train cars of Bakken crude involved in that Quebec explosion and fire in 2013 had a vapor pressure of about 9 psi, according to Canadian investigators. That's about the same volatility as gasoline sold in the summer in Minnesota. A search of public records and news reports identified 14 derailments involving crude oil trains in the past 2 years in North America. Fire was involved in 9 of the incidents. The federal government is reviewing proposed regulations to improve tank car safety. The industry standard tank car, known as the DOT 111 rail car, will be replaced. Millar says new regulations are unlikely to stop crude oil train accidents.
Anybody who's kind of hoping that somehow there's going to be this magic bullet, you know, or some new set of federal regulations that's going to make this situation safe, I mean, I have a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you.
A newer tank car with improved safety features, the CPC 1232, has been involved in at least 2 recent oil train derailments and explosion incidents. North Dakota's top oil regulator says inspectors will start checking oil on April 1st. Companies that violate the new regulation can be fined $12,500 per day. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
A third Minnesota turkey farm is infected with a deadly strain of bird flu. Over the weekend, the United States Department of Agriculture confirmed the disease had spread to Stearns County. More than 40 countries banned exports from Minnesota's $750 million turkey farming industry after thousands of turkeys died of the same flu virus earlier this month at farms in Pope and L'Aquaparle counties. Agriculture Commissioner Dave Fredrickson says he's hopeful the third outbreak won't slow Minnesota's return to international trade.
We're just hopeful, and we continue to send the message that our products are safe. We test birds that are going into the processing facility, and so our trade partners should have a level of comfort with that, and certainly our consumers here in Minnesota and in the U.S.
The Stearns County farm is quarantined, and the birds have been killed. Avian flu is not considered a threat to people, although workers are tested as a precaution. Light rail planners with the Metropolitan Council have come up with 4 station design types for the Southwest LRT project, and they're asking for input. The line would run from Minneapolis to Eden Prairie. Project spokeswoman Laura Bannon says the proposed designs will have common elements, but offer additional features.
The line will go through some residential neighborhoods, and the designs being suggested for those locations are understated. And then in the areas with a lot of commerce and traffic and general busyness, the designs are bolder, so the stations will stand out and be identified.
The public has its first chance to weigh in later this week as part of a series of open house events. The project is scheduled to start construction next year and open in 2019. Bannon says later in the process, artists will be selected to put their stamp on the stations. And that's the NPR News update for Monday, March 30th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.